Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a couple of subjects in the news. We'll talk about the war between Lebanon and Israel. We'll begin in a moment and go to the south of Lebanon and speak with Nick Blanford, who's a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. He has spent the day at the site of the bombing of the village in which civilians, including a number of children, were killed. We'll also talk with a well-known, prominent Israeli TV commentator and reporter for Haaretz, Yossi Melman. And then we will speak with Jim Bamford, who is the author of A Pretext for War, 9/11 Iraq, and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agency. He has a lead article in the current issue of Rolling Stone entitled Iran, the Next War. I'm speaking with Nick Blanford, who's a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, and he is in the south of Lebanon, and you don't have him yet, I see. I'm told you don't have him. Okay. Well, we will be waiting here to get through to Nick Blanford, his reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. I spoke with him a little while ago. He's been covering Lebanon for a number of years. He was just telling me that driving down to the village that was bombed was a deja vu. From 1996, he recalls, going down the same road to witness another atrocity, and it was a similar situation where ambulances roaring in the opposite direction and press heading down south. So I'm waiting to hear from Nick Blanford. Are you with us?
Nick? Yes, I am.
How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good to talk to you, where are you now? Because we spoke earlier, you had spent the day at the village that had been bombed, and
that's right. Now I'm back in Tyre.
Back in Tyre,
which is the town on the coast, about 6 miles from Kana.
And Kana was, of course, the site of the massacre back in 96 that you covered as well, and you were telling me earlier that it felt like a deja vu today.
Well, it was. We've all been expecting some sort of massacre to take place during this. There's so much ordnance flying around, so many heavy bombs being dropped by aircraft, so many helicopters strafing the roads, that sooner or later some serious casualties were going to happen. And of course, it did today in Kana. So this morning, when the news was true that there'd been mass casualties in Kana, we jumped in the cars, we went racing along these bomb-crated roads, the tires crunching on the rubble of bombed houses as we got there, and the wail of sirens and ambulances shooting back the other way. It was very, very similar to the scene 10 years ago when there was a larger massacre in Kana when Israeli artillery shelled the UN base and killed over 100 civilians sheltering there.
And why are these people still there, given the war raging around them, the civilians? Have they not been able to get out?
Well, that's right. The population of Kana is around 12,000, and the vast majority of them have left, because Kana has been very heavily hit since this whole operation got underway a little over 2 weeks ago. But these two families, two extended families, numbering around 53, 55 people, were sheltering in this half-finished house because they simply couldn't leave. They were saying that there are two roads leading away from the house. The house is on a steep hill on the outskirts of the village, and there are two roads that connect them to the main part of the village and the main road that would take them down to the relative safety of the coast. And these roads have been bombed and cratered. There was also rubble lying across it, so they simply couldn't get cars down to the house to take the people away, so they figured that they were better off staying put and hoping for the best.
And were there any Hezbollah fighters in the proximity of the house that anybody knows of?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
I said, is there evidence that the Hezbollah fighters were in and around the house that was targeted?
No, there wasn't any evidence at all. The Hezbollah guys, by and large, are down further south along the border fighting the Israeli ground incursions. And they're not staying in their homes anyway at the moment. I've come across several Hezbollah people in other villages, some villages which have been very heavily bombed, and basically all the residents have left, a handful of people. And there are Hezbollah people remaining in the ruins of these villages, remaining in contact with each other through walkie-talkies, providing some shelter and protection and food and water to whatever villagers are remaining behind, who couldn't leave. But in terms of actual fighters operating around Kana, I mean, there was absolutely no evidence of that in the area that was hit today.
Now, but is there any evidence that Hezbollah, which is what the Israelis charge, that they shelter close to civilian targets, perhaps hoping to create collateral damage, and that they were also close to the UN post that was targeted last week?
Right. They're not using civilian buildings and people as protection. This would be incorrect. They are operating out in the field. They're staying out in the field. They're on active combat duty now. Remember that Hezbollah is drawn from the local population anyway. So at the beginning of this operation, the Israelis, they had some fairly good intelligence, it seems, knew where a lot of Hezbollah people lived, and they struck these houses in the first 2 or 3 days in particular of the operation. They were hitting houses throughout South Lebanon where Hezbollah people live. Now, the thing is that the Hezbollah guys had already left into sort of combat duty out in the field, out in the bush. So the families were remaining behind in the house, and they were all being killed. Now, it's certainly true that they're firing from close to UN positions, and this has been a cause of great concern with the United Nations peacekeeping force in South Lebanon. There are daily reports of maybe 4, 5, 6 instances where Hezbollah is firing rockets or mortar rounds in close proximity to UN positions. So this is something that they used to do back in the 1990s when Israel was occupying South Lebanon as well. And it was a constant problem between the UN peacekeeping force and Hezbollah about this issue. Because the Israelis, of course, retaliate anyway. And that means that the peacekeepers are caught in the crossfire very often. And, we've had, I think, 4 have been killed and about another 8 have been wounded.
So, Nick Blanford, is there any evidence from you spending the day at this site that was bombed, and apparently it's the structure is pretty precarious? Is there any evidence of any military activities on the part of Hezbollah? Any rocket casings? Any shell casings? Anything that would suggest that they were either occupying that building or had been occupying that building?
No, there was nothing there. The half the building was completely destroyed and was basically a huge crater in the ground. And the half of the building had sort of the floors. There's a 3-story building and the floors had more or less collapsed on each other and the whole structure was sort of leaning over. If there had been some evidence of, be it military uniforms or helmets or weapons or whatever, they would have been visible. But, this is a pattern that we've been seeing throughout this conflict of houses being flattened. I was in a village called Srifa just yesterday. I was the first Western journalist to get up there since this conflict began. And it's been very heavily hit. I mean, an entire neighborhood completely flattened. A population of around 10,000 normally. There's just 50 or 60 people living in the ruins of their homes being looked after by Hezbollah people. So what happened today is not out of the ordinary, but it's obviously created so much attention simply because there happened to be over 50 people sheltering in the building when it was hit.
Well, Nick Blanford, is there any evidence that this military campaign of the Israelis is working in the sense that the idea was to degrade Hezbollah and defeat them and then eventually through the offices of the United Nations and through the brokering of Condoleezza Rice, some kind of UN-sponsored international force could come in there and secure that border and create a lasting peace? Because the excuse on the part of our administration here in the United States is that we can't have a ceasefire, we can't do any moves towards peace. We can only do it unless we got a guarantee that it's really going to work in the long term, and that's been their kind of mantra. And of course, on the face of it, it doesn't make much sense that you have to be guaranteed success before you begin. But that's the spin. So, walk me through what you think's happening there on the ground.
Well, the Israelis are encountering much stiffer resistance than they were expecting. They have no illusions about Hezbollah. They know that they're dealing with a formidable guerrilla force, one of the most professional guerrilla armies in the world, who, of course, drove Israeli forces out of South Lebanon in May 2000. Hezbollah has had 6 years to prepare for this showdown. And I think the Israelis are working out to a plan that they've had on the shelf for a long time as well. Everyone knew that this confrontation was going to happen one day. I remember talking to Hezbollah official long ago, as February 2002, and he was saying, yes, look, of course we're going to have a showdown with the Israelis, and everything we're doing in South Lebanon along the border is in preparation for that. So that meant the building of the sort of military infrastructure of bunkers, of observation posts, stockpiling rockets, keeping the weapons and rockets and ammunition scattered throughout South Lebanon, not keeping them in one or two ammunition dumps that, you know, the whole lot could go up with one hit. And this is why I think the Israelis have been encountering difficulties, not just in trying to hit the Katyusha rocket launches. They're still firing rockets of around 100 or so a day into Israel. But they're also having a great deal of difficulty fighting Hezbollah on the ground. The guys that are doing the fighting, and they number in their hundreds, that we're not talking about thousands, maybe 800 to 1,000 fighters on the ground. These are guys in their late 20s to mid-30s, combat veterans, schooled in the use of different weapons like anti-tank missiles. They're using anti-tank missiles that they've never used in South Lebanon before, and they've been able to knock out some of the Israeli armor, the tanks, with these missiles. They've booby-trapped houses. They love it when the Israelis come into the villages. There's been Bin Jebel, which is a large Shia town on the border, has seen some of the hardest fighting, and they had a very tough time there, the Israelis, and eventually pulled out. So today they've launched a new incursion, and there was fighting around another Shia village called Taibi. And there were reports of 8 Israeli soldiers being killed. This is what Hezbollah was claiming. I haven't seen any verification from the Israelis yet. But it's a long, slow, tough battle. I think the Israelis have realized that this is going to take time.
Well, just in closing, Nick Blanford, is it we get the impression that throughout the Arab world, and remember this, initially the Saudis and others condemned Hezbollah, and more the Sunni countries did, and now apparently their street has forced them to reverse that condemnation, and now they're supporting Hezbollah. So what's going to happen to this multicultural country of Lebanon, given that they're Christian and Sunni and secular Arabs there with this theocratic Hezbollah group? If they are triumphant, will that be Lebanon's fate, to become another Iran?
Well, I don't think it'll go that far, but the problem we have in Lebanon at the moment is that the Hezbollah is a very powerful political party that carries great weight in Lebanon by virtue of the fact that this is the representative of the Shia community in Lebanon. And the Shia are the largest of the various sects here. Now, all the other sects, be it the Christians or the Sunni Muslims, are very unhappy with this political party that retains a very strong and effective military wing. And they see that as giving the Shia community unfair advantage in the wheeling and dealing that is Lebanese politics. Now, what we've seen over the last couple of weeks, because of the scale and intensity of the Israeli onslaught on Lebanon, there has been a certain backlash, a sort of a growing support, I guess, for Hezbollah, certainly amongst the Shia community. So a lot of Shia were uneasy about Hezbollah's kidnapping of these two Israeli soldiers, which sparked this whole conflict, and feeling that they went a step too far. But because the Israeli offensive has been so beyond out of proportion of the initial act of kidnapping soldiers, that I'm finding that in this town of Tyre, where I am now, which is a very laid-back place, Hezbollah's never really gained traction here. The people are cold beer and fried fish too much to worry about politics. But I'm sensing with each passing day growing support amongst the local population here for Hezbollah, and indeed growing hostility towards the West. When you go out to the villages and talk to some of the people whose houses have been bombed, you're hearing them cursing the United States more than Israel. In a way, it's as if they expect this sort of thing from Israel, but they're outraged by the way that the West and the United States in particular has essentially stood back and allowed the Israelis free rein to do what they wish here.
Well, I thank you very much, Nick. I'm afraid we've run out of time, Nick, but I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles.
Sure,
Nick Blanford.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Nick Blanford, who's a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. He's down in the south of Lebanon where the village was bombed today. Let's now go to Israel. I'm speaking with Yossi Melman, who's a commentator and reporter with Haaretz. And following the latest bombing of the village in southern Lebanon, and Condoleezza Rice was supposed to go to Lebanon, and she's, I think, back in Israel, but she's reported to be going to return back to the United States. What's the local feeling there about the status of this, of her mission? Is it postponed, cancelled, or has it gone down in flames?
Well, first of all, the U.S. diplomacy is not the only game in town. There is a European European efforts and initiatives. There is a U.N. Diplomacy. And I believe that she is going back to the States to brief the president, to give him a real sense of what's going on in the field, in the area. And she might come back. I don't think it's the end of her diplomacy. After all, United States is supporting Israel, and the only reason why there is no ceasefire at the moment is because the United States is against it, following requests from Israel. Israel doesn't want to stop that the operation in the middle of it without achieving at least some of the goals that were set by the government.
Now, are they likely to achieve these goals? There's a sense that it's not going well militarily.
I disagree. It's going very well militarily. The fact that there was that tragedy in the village doesn't mean that the overall operation doesn't go well. It's a real tragedy, but civilians are killed on both sides. Hezbollah is targeting Israeli towns all the time, not military targets, while the Israeli forces, including the Air Force, is above all is trying to differentiate between Hezbollah targets and civilian targets. The problem is that Hezbollah, despite its despite boosting that it's an army, it's a guerrilla, and has a conscience, they find shelter among civilians. They are cowards in that sense. That's not a military honor. So the Israeli army is trying to pinpoint Hezbollah targets, and it's a risk taking. And this time, unfortunately, there was that tragedy. Now, the Israeli Prime Minister and Defense Minister made absolutely clear that they are not going to stop that operation because of 25 or 55. It's the number. The figures are not known yet. Were killed. The Israeli army is investigating the case. By the way, the Air Force said that they bombed that house at midnight local time, between Saturday and Sunday, and the house and the building collapsed 7 hours later and killed the people. And it's not clear what caused the collapse of the house. Maybe there were some explosives and rockets inside, and ammunition, Hezbollah ammunition inside the building. But all in all, I think the goals of the Israeli operation are quite clear: to remove Hezbollah positions from the border. And that has been partially achieved, and I believe that within 10 days will be achieved.
And tell me, Yossi Melman, just in terms of the where the Israeli people are, because the impression you get is that there is the peace movement that was very active, as you remember, back in 82, when Ariel Sharon led the invasion of Lebanon. There was tremendous backlash and hundreds of thousands of people in the street. I take it that there isn't really an anti-war peace caucus in the streets.
No, there is a desire for peace and tranquility among all Israelis. But I would say 85 to 90% of the Israeli public do support the government this time. This is a war not about occupation. This is not a war about aims to create a new order in the Middle East, to crown someone as the president of Lebanon, as were the hidden goals of Sharon and Begin in 1982. This is basically a war initiated by Hezbollah against the borders of 67. These are the internationally recognized borders of Israel. And I myself have been all my life, if you wish, a peacenik. I have been all my life against the occupation, in favor of the Palestinian state, against the all the things that the Israeli occupation caused to the Palestinian people on a daily basis, abuses and atrocities and whatever. But this time, I find myself in a position when all my old beliefs and ideology are under fire. They are challenged. Hezbollah, I don't understand many liberal voices in the United States or in Europe. They support Hezbollah. Who is Hezbollah? This is a fundamentalist organization supported by Iran, calling for a theocracy in Lebanon, not in Israel. But Hezbollah's manifesto is for a theocracy to be established in Lebanon. So I don't understand how people can support them. True, it's also a grassroots organization. They have a welfare system. They have hospitals. They have schools. But above all, it's a fundamentalist organization whose aims are very clear: to have a Shiite pro-Iranian theocracy in Lebanon and to whip out Israel of the Middle East.
Now, do you think that the statements by Ahmadinejad, the Iranian leader, saying that he wants Israel wiped off the face of the earth, and the extent to which Hezbollah is perceived as an agent or a puppet of Iran, is that widespread in amongst the Israeli population? Do they really feel that the hand of Iran is behind this, and that this is a step towards wiping them off the face of the earth?
Well, first of all, yes, most Israelis do believe it. Secondly, I am not sure that this war was planned and initiated by Iran. It was spontaneous. It was caused by a failure on the Israeli side and by an operation which I don't think that Hezbollah really had thought of extending it. It's just a coincidence that it happened the way it happened. Israel simply said enough is enough after that local attack on Israel, on an Israeli position, and the kidnapping of two Israeli soldiers. But there is no doubt that Iran is behind Hezbollah. I mean, they are not hiding it. Hezbollah is an advanced command post of Iran in Lebanon, and their largest achievement in the area. Iran failed to export its revolution to Sudan, to the Horn of Africa, and to other parts of the Middle East, and its only success is in Lebanon with Hezbollah. Now, Hezbollah is a Lebanese organization, but it is dancing to the tunes of Tehran. Most Israelis believe that Iran is behind Hezbollah, and that's why they support the war. And it's not only a physical war where people on both sides are innocent, people are victims. This is also a war about the conscience and awareness, and it's a psychological warfare. I'm sure that Iran is looking at what is happening here very carefully, how strong Israel is, how strong the Israeli population is, whether they could sustain the endless shelling and rockets that have been going on nearly for 20 days. And they would try to draw lessons from it. And that's, most Israelis do understand it. And you can hear a lot of voices in Israel of ordinary people, not necessarily experts and politicians and leaders and generals. People who are saying that if we break down this time, our future existence on this planet would be even more fragile.
Well, just in closing, Yossi Melman, there's been some speculation here in the United States that the fact that Ehud Olmert and Amir Peretz, the labor leader and defense minister, are relative neophytes vis-a-vis the military, that had a general like Sharon or Barak or Rabin been in the prime minister, they may have not have to feel that they have to prove themselves to the military. Is there an element of that in this reaction to the Hezbollah capturing these two soldiers?
Could be. But on the other hand, you have to understand that the military has been advocating a retaliation, a massive retaliation for years. Immediately after the withdrawal from Lebanon in 2000, the military, especially the intelligence military, which was providing information, they were saying, look what is happening in front of our eyes. The Hezbollah is building a state within a state in Lebanon, near the Israeli border. And they have accumulated 12,000 rockets, and they are going to fire it against Israel. So we better preempt. But all governments in Israel, from Barak to Sharon, refused to do it due to a lot of circumstances, and there are a lot of explanations why they rejected military options. This time, I believe that Ehud Olmert and Amir Peretz, yes, they want to prove themselves, not in front of the military, but more to prove them in the eyes of the Israeli public. And secondly, they reached the conclusion that enough is enough, as the prime minister said. This was a test that he was put into it, and the Israeli public was put into it, and he decided that he'll match the test.
I thank you so much for joining us, Yossi Melman.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Yossi Melman, who's a well-known Israeli TV commentator and reporter for Haaretz. Let's now go to the subject of the next war with Iran. I'm speaking with James Bamford, who's the author of the bestsellers Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace. He's written extensively on national security issues, including cover stories in the New York Times magazine, Washington Post magazine, and Los Angeles Times. His most recent book is A Pretext for War, 9/11, Iraq, and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agency. And his latest major feature is for Rolling Stone, the current issue entitled Iran, the Next War. And in your article, James Bamford, you point out that that the precursor to this bombs falling at the moment in Lebanon perhaps goes back even before bombs fell on Baghdad. A group of senior Pentagon officials were plotting to invade another country. Their covert campaign once again relied on false intelligence and shady allies, but this time the target was Iran. So where are the plotters at this point?
Well, one other difference is this time it was illegal, since one of the people involved, one of the senior Pentagon officials, has already been arrested, pled guilty, and the other two people are waiting for trial. But what happened was that one of the people from the same office that was planning the Iraq War, the Office of Special Plans in the Pentagon, which was run by Doug Feist, basically. He was in charge of the overall office. One of the people assigned to that office, Larry Franklin, met with people from the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, the AIPAC, the chief lobby group for Israel. They got together, and Franklin passed on top-secret information to the AIPAC people in order for AIPAC to help pressure the White House for regime change in Iraq. It was a goal that they both wanted, and at the time, the White House was listening what they felt was too closely to the State Department, to Colin Powell, who was arguing for more for diplomacy and non-confrontational attitude towards Iran, and they were pushing for regime change. So Franklin thought that by dealing with passing the information on to AIPAC, even though it was top secret and illegal, that AIPAC would then be able to use their clout with the White House to change the policy from diplomacy to action.
And this was against Iran. You said Iraq.
I'm sorry, yeah.
I know it's hard to keep up nowadays.
Right, because it was right at the same time. I mean, we're only talking about a week before and to a short time afterwards. So it was right around that same time that they were plotting the war in Iraq, and they were also planning this new war in Iran.
Now, I understood because it's worth pointing out that Franklin was caught earlier, and he essentially was given a choice of 20 or 30 years in jail or to cooperate with the FBI, and he was wired for this meeting, wasn't he, by the FBI?
No, this meeting he didn't know about.
I see.
The FBI had been secretly eavesdropping on his communications and also the on AIPAC's communications. The original investigation was on AIPAC, and Franklin happened to walk into it. So they were the FBI was secretly watching this one. Later, when he did later on, he did cooperate when the FBI arrested him and gave an option of cooperating, and then he broke off cooperation after he got an attorney and eventually pled guilty.
And in his plea, he said his excuse, if you will, was the reason he was giving top secret information to the Israeli lobby was that he was trying to get into their good graces because they had a lot of clout with the National Security Council and Elliot Abrams and others there, and that he wanted a job. He was angling for a job. So,
well, actually, it was the Israeli lobby, the AIPAC people, who came up with the idea and suggested that he go to work for the National Security Council. And the actual quote from the intercepted conversation was, "That way you'll be sitting at the elbow of the president." And Franklin was very much in favor of that and asked them to go ahead and try to do that. So the whole idea, one of the key ideas here was to get Franklin, who was, in the same frame of mind in terms of regime change in Iran, to get him and place him at the elbow of the president in the White House.
Well, either way, I mean, it's an extraordinary revelation that the way to get promoted to the United States National Security Council is via the Israelis.
That's right. They felt they could easily do that. They pick up a phone or have a meeting, and one of their people is working in the NSC. They've gotten a lot of cooperation in the past from the people in the NSC. Although they weren't indicted, there was at least one key member of the National Security Council who passed some of the information on to the two AIPAC people, Rosen and Wiseman. There's been this long interaction between AIPAC and the NSC in both Democratic and Republican administrations.
And curiously, one of the characters in your story in the current issue of Rolling Stone, Jim Bamford, Michael Ledeen, he was actually fired from the Reagan National Security Council for passing secrets to the Israelis.
I don't mention that in my piece because I wasn't able to confirm that he was fired for that. So, that might have been actually somebody else who was fired for that in the Reagan NSC. His problem in the Reagan National Security Council was that he was sort of the mastermind behind the largest scandal that ever took place in the history of the Reagan administration. He was the one who acted as the intermediary and largely came up with the idea of trading arms for hostages, which evolved into the Iran-Contra affair during the Reagan administration. So that was Michael Ledeen. And the interesting thing was, one of the key reasons for that scandal was because Michael Ledeen began dealing with a con man from Iran by the name of Manachar Gurbanifar. And he was sort of like a Ahmed Chalabi type character. It's very similar to Ahmed Chalabi, who was wanting the U.S. to invade Iraq. Ghorbanifar wanted U.S. to invade Iran. And so that led to this enormous scandal during the Reagan administration when Ledeen was dealing with Ghorbanifar. And then in 2001, Ledeen goes back to the Pentagon and into the White House and suggests that he start dealing with Ghorbanifar again. And that's what happened. So
These were the Rome meetings that took place.
They had a meeting in Rome, a very secret meeting in Rome between Ledeen and Franklin and another person from the NSC and also Ghorbanifar. In addition, there were a number of Iranian defectors that Ledeen and Ghorbanifar brought. Ghorbanifar basically brought these defectors from Iran. And again, this was very similar to what was happening around that very same time with Iraq, where the Pentagon was dealing with this defector, Ahmed Chalabi. He was bringing these defectors who had all this bogus information. And the main goal was for Chalabi to get the war in Iraq, and here it was, Ghorbanifar was bringing these phony defectors from Iran with same similar type of information, and they were hoping for a war in Iran.
But specifically, wasn't there a deal being, they were trying to broker a swap, were they not, with some high-value people that had escaped from Afghanistan when the United States invaded after 9/11, and they were trying to swap them for the MEK, the Mujahideen al-Haq?
Well, what was happening was that the original reason that Ledeen and Ghorbanifar said was the original idea of the meeting was that these Iranians were going to talk about possible locations where Americans might be attacked by Iranians in Iraq. It turns out the Pentagon ended up saying nothing ever became of that. And one of the key things they were doing over there was a meeting that was taking place between the White House and Iranian officials dealing with the possibility of exchange or release of some al-Qaeda members. Well, the
I believe one of them included one of bin Laden's sons, didn't it?
Yeah, somebody very close to bin Laden. And the neocons didn't want that to happen because they were afraid that that would again lead to this close detente between the U.S. And Iran. And at the same time, it would be an opening that they didn't want to happen. So they were arguing with, they were hoping that deal would fall through, and instead they were hoping that the White House would side with going along with the MEK, which was very similar to the Chalabi's Iraqi National Congress. The MEK was a terrorist organization, actually, that was branded by the State Department of Terrorist Act. Activity, and they were a group of people that were located in Iraq, and they were launching sort of terrorist attacks against Iran. And the neocons and Ledeen and Ghorbanifar wanted the White House to support that group and not to support exchange for the al-Qaeda members being held there.
Well, so that we don't lose the audience here on all of these names and plots, the long and the short of it is that the neocons were both, at the same time they're trying to gin up a war with Iraq and their point man being Chalabi, they were also plotting for the next war against Iran. And curiously and ironically, their hero, their point man, Chalabi, was, in fact, double-dealing, and he was an agent for Iran all along, and the United States has had been able to read Iran's mail, its diplomatic mail, basically since going back to the Marine Barracks bombing in 83. That's how they were able to find out the Hezbollah's involvement in that. So they had the NSA had the ability to eavesdrop on all Iranian communications, and then suddenly, after I believe Chalabi visited the Iranian ambassador in Baghdad, the tap dried up.
Well, the irony here was that the man, the neocons, were hoping to open the door to war with Iraq in order for them to oust Saddam Hussein and put Chalabi in. Chalabi was actually, the FBI came to the conclusion that he's probably an agent of the Iranian government. So here they were launching a war in order to put an agent from their mortal enemy into power in Iran, in Iraq, and to some degree that's what's happened. It's become a very Shiite-dominated country now, very close to Iran, and it was all because of Chalabi, largely, for pushing all this in the first place. What happened was that Chalabi was observed meeting with somebody very high up in the Iranian government, somebody who was known to be very hostile to the United States, and they started putting two and two together and figured he was the person who had leaked the information that caused the NSA to completely lose their ability to break Iranian codes. So Chalabi came under enormous investigation by the FBI, and the case is still open. The problem is that the administration began protecting Chalabi, even though the FBI wanted to question him. When Chalabi came to the United States, the Bush administration blocked the FBI from questioning Chalabi about this.
And that was relatively recently, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was only last November. So, and that was according to a senior official at the FBI who spoke to me confidentially that he was very frustrated because they wanted to question Chalabi about this. And because he was under State Department protection, they had to get permission from the State Department. The State Department basically wouldn't let the FBI question Chalabi. So he left the country without ever being questioned on the issue of whether he is the guy who passed on the NSA secrets about breaking the Iranian code to the Iranian government.
Let me just remind the audience again, I'm speaking with James Bamford, who's the author of the bestsellers Bodies of Secrets and the Puzzle Palace, his recent book, A Pretext for War, 9/11 Iraq and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agency. He also has the major feature in the current issue of the Rolling Stone magazine entitled Iran, The Next War, which is, and he's also formerly the Washington Investigative Producer for ABC News. But in terms of the Israeli connection here with AIPAC and the Larry Franklin arrest and the indictments of the two lobbyists, Steve Rosen and Keith Weissman, there's also a lot of involvement here with, Franklin was getting together regularly with Nahor Gilon at the Israeli embassy. Gilon had suggested that Franklin meet with Uzi Arad, who's the former director of intelligence for Mossad and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's former foreign policy advisor. And then later Franklin had lunch in the Pentagon cafeteria with Uzi Arad. I spoke to Colonel Karen Katowski, who worked in the OSP in Doug Feith's shop over there at the Pentagon. She said that the place is like a revolving door for Israeli generals. They were there all the time. So,
yeah.
What is this relationship here that where Israel I mean, the whole world looks at the fecklessness of Bush and Blair, and particularly Condoleezza Rice, where they say they can't do anything until they can have a comprehensive deal. We can't have a ceasefire until we solve all of the problems in the Middle East, which of course is fatuous and unattainable, at least so far. So the world looks upon the paralysis of the United States as either very cynical, either Israel's doing the dirty work for the United States, or conversely, the tail is wagging the dog, and the U.S. is sitting on the sidelines waiting for Israel's permission to seek a ceasefire. So give us a sense of not conjecture, but reality here in terms of how much the Israeli military and intelligence people seem to have extraordinary access to the Pentagon.
Well, the access was virtually total during the early days of the Bush administration. Probably still is total today, but in looking at it. One of the reasons why it was the Israelis had such a close relationship with the Pentagon was that Fife, for example, was one of the people who drafted this document back in 1996 called the Clean Break Memorandum. Fife, Richard Perle, and David Wilmser, who's the Middle East advisor to Cheney today, they all drafted this. They were all out of office at the time, and they were basically working as consultants for newly elected Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and they drafted a foreign policy plan for him. And part of that foreign policy plan involved ousting Saddam Hussein from Iraq and then invading both Lebanon and Syria and eventually moving on to Iran. So they had this plan in the works since 1996, and then they all take high offices in the Bush administration. And after 9/11, they had this opportunity to put that plan into operation. So they became very, very close to the Israelis because that was exactly what the Israelis wanted. And you had especially the war in Iraq and also this attempt to get the U.S. involved in a war in Iran. So they had meetings regularly with Israeli senior intelligence officials, generals, and so forth. And it was literally a revolving door over the Pentagon. The Israeli intelligence officials would come in. They'd meet Franklin in the Pentagon Athletic Club, and Frank would pass on secret information to them. And then at one point they, offered to Franklin that he could meet the former head of Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency. And he had this meeting right in the Pentagon dining room. So it looked like there was, you can put a piece of paper between the U.S. and Israel in terms of their actions and what they wanted. So the Bush administration and the Israelis had the same goal, both Iraq, war in Iraq, and a war in Iran.
Well, but the irony is that the war in Iraq has rewarded Iran, made them much more powerful. You can tell that Ahmadinejad now is tweaking the United States and taunting them, clearly, Iran is in the catbird seat, and it's gotten the Sunni neighborhood, the Saudis and Egyptians and Jordanians and the Gulf, particularly Bahrain, terrified. And everybody's tearing their hair out on the Sunni side and saying to the Americans, for God's sake, you've unleashed this monster. As far as I know, the Israelis aren't particularly happy with the ascendancy of Iran. So how could they have screwed up this badly?
Well, in writing this story, I point out that when Franklin and the Pentagon people finally discover that Chalabi had been pretty much double-dealing them and that this had been done for Iran, they began getting very panicky, and Franklin leaked the information about Chalabi, basically, to CBS at the time, and he leaked the fact, also wanted to get out the fact that they didn't know that Chalabi had the secret meetings with the Iranian government. And just so they could, get the message out to the public and the rest of the world that they were taken as much by surprise as this as anybody. So then, without using Franklin's name, CBS broadcast that on the evening news program very soon after it happened, and the leak came from Franklin, which was another count on the indictment against him because he leaked the information to CBS. So, and everything we're talking about here, this isn't speculation. This is information that comes from the original indictment that Franklin pled guilty to.
So how, Jim Bamford, how does this tie into the current war between Israel and Lebanon? And there's a, the Israelis feel that Hezbollah is the agent of Iran, and that Iran is tweaking them both through Hamas on one side and Hezbollah on the other border. And that is echoed by the administration, by both the president and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. So, is this war that they planned against Iran, after having effectively rewarded Iran by their blunder in Iraq, where does it stand? I know Cy Hirsch has been saying that they've got plans, but I understand that the professional military told the White House that you're crazy, you can't do anything. There's nothing militarily we can do against Iran. It'll backfire. And the CIA told them that if you try and go after Iran, they will unleash Hezbollah. So,
the irony here is that both the U.S. and Israel were pushing for the war and got the war in Iraq. And then what happened was, now they have a much more empowered Iran because of their involvement in Iraq, and now because of Israelis' attacks against Hezbollah in southern Lebanon and in Beirut, they've got a much more widely respected and powerful Hezbollah. So it seems like everything they're doing makes everything completely worse than it was before. And yeah, in terms of the reality of whether they can attack Iran now, certainly they can't have any kind of a ground war. They have barely enough people to move from the outskirts of Baghdad into Baghdad to beef up Baghdad.
Well, Jim Bamford, it's pretty well known within the United States military in Iraq that with one telephone call, the Iranians could unleash hell and essentially drive the United States out of Iraq.
And I think that's one of the problems, was this underestimation of both Iran and Hezbollah. Clearly the Israelis underestimated their power against Hezbollah. There's always this myth that we'll just do a few strategic air attacks and that will clear up the problem. And as you can see in both Iraq and in Iran, that strategic strikes don't really solve anything. So they thought that attacking Iran strategically in certain areas to go after their alleged nuclear weapons activity, that would be the end of it. But it was clear that if they did that, they would completely unleash Iran throughout the entire region. And as you can see what happens just when the Israelis are going after Hezbollah, the problem they're having.
Well, we know, I think, that inevitably we've already lost the war in Iraq, and it's just a matter of time before we're either forced to withdraw or we have to retreat into the Kurdish area, which is the only safe part of Iraq that's left. So just in closing, Jim Bamford, I always thought the Israelis were a lot smarter and they knew the Middle East better than we did. So is this total screw-up because the neocons are running the United States foreign policy and the Israeli foreign and military policy? I mean, what's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, you can't think of a country as being smart, a country that has never been able to get peace after 50 years. So it's just one screw up after another, and right now they're in one of the worst positions they've ever been. So I think it's a question of arrogance over intelligence, and you know, whether the U.S. is leading Israel or Israel is leading the U.S., both of them working together for these this changing the Middle East to the betterment of both of them, it completely backfired, and the Middle East is worse today than it's probably ever been since the 67 war.
Well, thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, James Bamford.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with James Bamford, who is the author of the bestsellers Body of Secrets and The Puzzle Palace. He's written extensively for the New York Times Magazine, Washington Post Magazine, Los Angeles Times Magazine. His most recent book is A Pretext for War, 9/11 Iraq, and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agencies. And he has a major feature in the current issue of the Rolling Stone magazine entitled Iran, the Next War. And he was also formerly the Washington investigative producer for ABC News. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Coote, the assistant producer, and I thank Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.